I just want to take a little bit of time, a short time, so to speak, to start the conversation. And I'm going to ask, this time I am going to ask the front you, persons to volunteer to think about the following question. And I'm asking some of you to share your thoughts on this. So the question is this: what do you think poverty is? And when in your own personal life did you become aware of the fact that you really want to do something about poverty, about changing conditions of life? When was the first time? What is when you were a 3-year-old, 5-year-old, you know, 25-year-old? When was the moment when you said, I care about poverty and I am going to do something about it? Can we have some stories, a few stories about that? I'm going to tell you why I'm doing this. And I had seen Eka's hand.
Thank you. I'd like to express my ideas about poverty. You see, I see the poverty is not the same thing, and it is changing over the country. Poverty in Africa is totally different from poverty in my country, and poverty in my country is totally different from Nordic countries. You see, it depends on condition. But in totally, to say it's no access to basic needs of human being and no access to the basic rights of human beings in totally.
Is not having access to basic needs or provisioning, and not having access to the rights, or not being able to exercise basic rights. So, right. And can you recall a moment when you in your life when you said to yourself, "I really want to do something about poverty," using the word poverty, because as an economist, you would have said that, but as even as a child.
You see, I was my childhood was during Soviet period. In Soviet period, it was regarded that poverty was not in place. You see, so maybe when I was grown up and when Soviet Union was collapsed and all countries of Soviets experienced deep economic crisis, it was the first time when we faced the poverty in our lives, or in not at sight, but in our lives, you see. And it was, how to say, very strange for the people, because we do experience during the years that we have all basic provisions and we exercise our rights that we had in this period. I mean, Soviet period, we had not all rights, but we exercised them. And it was totally poverty of all population. So it was the first time when I meet personally poverty. And we worked a lot on the country, but that does not mean that all people managed to overcome poverty. Later on, when I finished my graduation and I begin to work, it's a UNDP project. It was a joint project of UNDP and government, and we traveled all the regions. Then I see the real poverty in the country in rural areas, and it was terrible, by the way, because it was totally different one that I experienced in my life, and I thought that I was in poverty, you see. So it was then in 1997, when I see poverty in rural areas, when I see when people are suffering from this poverty, when they are dying, and the direct meaning of this word, and when they have no food, no health care, no education because of poverty. It was in 1997, but even now, today, even in Georgia, we have some people that live below the level of poverty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to say Eka is talking about Georgia, but this is probably not also the experience of many of the countries in that region. So, you know, Georgia is an example of the countries of. In fact, we could say these are the kinds of countries which made a transition to through impoverishment, And this exactly is the period of what I call primitive accumulation. Primitive accumulation in the Marxian sense of primitive accumulation. And this was the this is a period in history where in the Soviet or former Soviet countries we have the most incredible and this horrendous redistribution of property from publicly being publicly owned to being privately owned, and in this sense we call it the primitive accumulation in the historical and analytical sense that Marx used it. I am saying this because I'm going to talk about primitive accumulation and also Western Europe later. Yes, any other storytellers?
Good morning, everyone. Okay. Taitu Heron from Kingston, Jamaica, west of the Caribbean. I'm a development practitioner and NGO activist. I currently work at the Planning Institute of Jamaica as a program manager and a researcher. That's my day job. My NGO work, pretty much feminist activism for women's rights, sexual reproductive health at the moment, and sometimes a focus on gender-based violence. My first inclination to do something about people's, I guess you would say it was social well-being, not necessarily poverty, but social well-being, was when I was about 8 years old. And it was the first time I'd actually witnessed a car accident and witnessed somebody experiencing bodily harm, I guess we could call it that. And it was about just outside my gate, not too far out from our gate. And there was a lot of commotion outside because there was a car accident right by, there was a bridge near to the house. And the car had turned over. And the person's body was stuck in the car. And they had called the ambulance, they had called the police, and nobody was coming anytime soon. So it was really up to the persons in the neighborhood to get the person, get the guy out of the car. And the tragedy of it was that the neighborhood was a very, it was a relatively low-income neighborhood. I wouldn't call it extreme poverty, but it was a working-class neighborhood. So very few persons in the neighborhood actually had a vehicle that we could carry him to a hospital, and the hospital actually wasn't even very far. And based on, when they pulled his body out of the car, one leg was, he pretty much lost one leg, you know. So he needed immediate attention. He was losing a lot of blood, and as much as people around wanted to help, they didn't have the skills to help. And the police didn't come for another hour and a half, and the ambulance didn't even get there. So basically, the police had to carry him to the hospital, and he lost his leg. And he didn't lose his leg because he didn't have to lose his leg. It was really just a lack of attention and a lack of responsiveness by the healthcare system at the time to that kind of immediate attention that would have needed. And I think back in that time, I'm not going to date myself, for me it was really traumatic because as I was 8 and I saw everything. You know, I saw the blood, I saw his body, I saw everybody in the neighborhood trying to help and still not being able to help. And then I saw the lack of, when he finally got to the hospital, they responded from what I hear, because my mother had gone to the hospital as well. But after that, it just kind of made me, I didn't get a good impression of the system, so to speak. And I think what struck me was that if you had money, then you could call an ambulance, and the ambulance, a private ambulance could come. But if you didn't have the money, then the public ambulance was few and, you know, there were few and far between. And honestly, I can't really say that has changed much in Jamaica.
And you were about 8 years old. Yes. Right. Yes. So poverty kills. Eka said poverty kills. Titus' story just tells us very clearly how poverty kills.
Okay, my name is Noon Koulibaly. I'm from Cote d'Ivoire. It's called Ivory Coast in English. Well, this poverty thing is, I mean, a very serious matter, but a very serious matter when you actually experience what poverty is in the rural area. And when I was in school and just after school, what I was taught is, I mean, poverty is just about income poverty. And in 2003, I was conducting a poverty, I mean, assessment, especially qualitative analysis of poverty. And I went to the rural areas to see how people actually live poverty. And then most of the people in the rural area will not believe that poverty is just a lack of money. It is about human rights, it is about dignity, it is about being able to handle day-to-day specific problem that the family is facing, and you cannot. And you sit there and you watch the kid, I mean, crying and crying and crying, and this really was what they define as poverty. And so I start working on poverty issues, and actually I met the guy from the World Bank at the first time when I was working on poverty, and I realized that the estimate of poverty for different countries are actually wrong. And he's right when he said, yeah, the estimate are actually wrong, because they use some kind of arc elasticities and GDPs and estimate poverties, and they sometimes underestimate actually the poverty rate. So we start conducting some other project to actually estimate real poverty rate for the country. But the story is, when you actually conduct a poverty study and there is a plan, an economic plan in the country, that plan actually is working for the long term, is not working immediately. Like the PRSP, this is a long-term issue. So what do you do immediately to help those people that you have found on the field who are suffering from poverty? And this is really the area where I'm looking now. So what we are doing is, after the study, we will imagine some sort of project to relieve people from living into poverty. So the immediate response to poverty, this is what I'm currently interested in. And so we are trying to conduct some project in the country to help people increase their well-being in, I mean, an immediate fashion, how to give them the immediate likelihood that they need.
Thank you so much. We are seeing a pattern in the way that everybody's talking about poverty. Any other storyteller? Sylvia.
Sure. My name is Sylvia Tereka. I come from Uganda. First of all, I would like to say that poverty means different things, and I guess as Eka said, really, it means different things to different people on different regions. But recently, less than 3 weeks before I came here, I really came into contact with real poverty. Because a relative of mine in the village had been bitten by a snake. And you know, snake poison is really very, very, very dangerous. Because if nothing is done, then it can lead either to death or you lose something. So when I went to the village, I found my relative. He was in the home okay, before I got to the house, I could see him, you know, he was limping like this, and I said, God, why is this guy walking in such a funny way? And when I got to him, I found that his leg, the foot was, it had really swollen, you know, it was so frightening. And then I said, what happened? So he told me that he had been bitten by a snake 2 days earlier. And you know, there were people around in the household. So, you know, like no one was able to do something about it. You know, I said, have you got any medicine or what? He said, no. And this was, these are relatives in the home who keep our home and who are not working. So I had to take this guy to the hospital. I drove him because I had a car, and it was miles away from the home. But even then, there was a nearby health center where he could have gone. But of course, there is not much attention there, drugs and all that kind of thing. So that health center, although it was accessible to him, it was really useless to him. So I had to drive him to an urban center and got treatment for him. But then the doctor said, if you had not really come, you know, like in time, and that was 2 days, he said, this guy was going to lose his leg, you know. If it had taken some bit of more time, they would have cut off the leg. So can you imagine someone was going to lose a leg? Why? He had no money, and the nearby health center was, in a way, not accessible, in the sense that there was no help there.
Thank you very much for sharing that. Roxana, are there others?
I'm Roxana Guerra from Peru. Well, since my childhood, I travel a lot, especially into Peru, and to Andean region, to the altitude, Puno, things like that, places like that. And I could saw, especially what touched me, or was the kids, that it was the weather was very, very cold, 4,000 meters altitude, with no shoes, or with nothing, no? The skin of them was brown, no, by the sun, etc. And in that moment, I started to think, I think I have to do something. When I started to study at university, I have to choose one specialty, no. So I think I have good teachers, especially in development. So I decided to work in this matter. And now, through my job in the European Union, I directly work against the poverty. It's the main goal of this cooperation. I remember always the NGOs which I work then, that we have to put this goal as the priority. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Mira?
My name is Mira, and I'm from Palestine. So, my mother comes originally from a refugee camp in Bethlehem. So, because she used to work, and my father was a political prisoner most of the time. So, my grandmother raised us in the refugee camp. Most of the time we were spending there. And this story is about a guy who was shot while in one of the demonstrations. He was 15 years old, and like Israeli soldiers, they use the bullets that called dum dum, which actually, when enter your body, explode inside. So it what happened to him is they had to take all of his inside parts out, like they had to take it because it was totally damaged. And then his family was poor, and like even with all the helps, they couldn't keep him in the hospital for a long time, and they couldn't send him to Israeli hospital or travel, like send him outside to have proper medication. So I remember he used to stay in the house, not able to eat anything, and they had to do all of these food for him from the machines. But like I he was the neighbor of my grandmother, and we used to go all the time to play with him because I was only 5 years, and he used to play with me all the time. So I will just as a kid will go to the person who will give me the love and attention and everything. So for 3 years, I all the time, whenever I go there, I just go to him. I say, show me the machines you have in your like in your body, because for me it was like. It was weird because he was like different from us. He can't move very much. He has to lay down all the time. And after 3 years of living like this and me going to play with him every day, every weekend, once I just went running to his room and the room was empty. So I asked where Muhammad went. And they said that he had to go because others asked for him. So I didn't understand for it that what happened to him. But then I asked my grandmother. My grandmother said that he couldn't live anymore. Like he had to end his suffering and everything. So after that, I understood that he died. But then I asked her why he died. Because he can go to the hospitals like others and everything. So she said that it's too expensive to send him to the hospital. And that was the first time I understand what poverty is and what is injustice, you know, because for me, I never understand until now why people has to die because they don't have money or because they're born to be, for example, Palestinians or born to be Pakistani or from Afghanistan, from Iraq. So that was the first time I was like shocked, but why people had to die because they don't have the money to live.
Thank you very much for sharing that. The world is a violent place. It's a very uncivilized place. We have been talking about that for a long time. And of course, poverty itself is violence. It is structural violence. It is nothing other than violence. And obviously, we're all aware of that. But the point is to make sure that we engage others who do not necessarily see poverty in these terms. The point is for us to really challenge that and to engage people to challenge the kinds of notions of poverty they have, and to make this point very, very strongly, loud and clear, that poverty is nothing other than violence. And it is, there are many different forms of violence, of course. And as we heard in these stories that you're sharing with us, and I'm sure each and every one of you has many, many similar stories to tell us. So there are many, many different forms of violence, but poverty is what is called structural violence. It is structural violence. And very often, this structural violence is not visible. This is one of the problems of why we have so much poverty as we have. Now, I'm going to tell you why I asked to sort of start this way, the discussion, because I used to work in the late 90s at UNDP as economic advisor in the Bureau for Development Policy, and the division I worked in was called Social Development and Poverty Elimination Division. And actually, we did sit down one day, and those of us in this division, we sat down one day. You know, you're in the UN, you're doing a lot of meetings, everybody's going from this to that, etc., all these things. One day we said, but we would always personally talk about all kinds of stories, but we said, we're going to actually sit down and talk about why each one of us cares about poverty. What is our personal, when did our personal consciousness about poverty come about? And we actually sat down and did this. We sat around the table and we started telling personal stories. And also, this is sort of to think about why it is that we are all working in this division, because we were not working there to do a job, to have a career. We were all very committed to doing everything we possibly could
to fight poverty. But we started with our personal stories, and one of my colleagues, who's from India, so everybody was telling their stories, and he said, of course, right now, anybody who looks at me will see me as a very privileged person, but I grew up in a village, I was very poor, and I did not have any shoes to wear. But of course, people will not be able to tell that when they look at me right now, because I am someone who's working at the United Nations Development Program, and I am working on poverty and trying to help the poor people. But he said, that's what I was. I was the child. I was exactly like the child, like the children who I go and visit when I do my work on an everyday basis. So he said that, and then I said, I was telling my story, I said, and I was the child. I came from a middle class background. I was the child who was taught that I have some responsibility when I see poor children in the street. I was the child who then looked at the poor children and asked the question, what is the difference between me and them? What have I done to deserve what I have? And this is true because when I grew up, and I'm from Turkey, I grew up in Turkey, and I still live in Turkey, of course, part of the time. When I grew up in Turkey, we would have a lot of people begging on the street, you know, panhandling, and we still do. By the way, in New York, there are a lot of people who do the same thing. So it's not like this is only happening in the third world and developing countries and others. So it happens. It depends on whether how much people open their eyes and so on. But anyway, there would be a lot of people on the street begging, asking for money and so on, poor people. And I was taught by my parents that I could not simply walk by. If I saw someone who needed something or was begging, then, you know, we had to stop, talk to the person, and then, you know, give something. But you had to talk to the person. It wasn't like you take something, you give it and say goodbye. You talk to the counselor. And my father would actually have extensive conversations on the street with people. I mean, he'd ask about their families, what, you know, and so on. So there would be this, you know, interaction on the street with this person. So, and oftentimes it would be maybe a mother who would be, you know, panhandling or begging with a child next to her. So here I am. I'm standing next to my father. I am all, you know, dressed up very nicely as a middle class child and so on. And I'm with my father or with my mother. And there is another child who doesn't have the clothes that I have. And we are sort of my mother or my father is engaging in a kind of, in an act of kindness. But then I'm asking the question, why are we the ones doing the act of kindness? It is, why do we deserve to be the ones to be engaging in the kind of actness? Why isn't it the other way around? Why do I have the shoes that I have and this girl who's facing me doesn't? And I think I was about 6 years old when I really, really started asking this question, because this was actually a very something that occurred in my life very often, of these encounters, so to speak. So, and I would, you know, ask my parents these questions and so on. I think this is when I became conscious of poverty as not something that was sort of accidental, that happened to some people because there was so much of it. And I knew my place as the privileged person. So many of us have many, many similar stories, but the point is that, and I don't know how to, no, tone. I need technical assistance. Okay. It is very, very important for really people to ask these kinds of questions, to reflect on their own personal history. And actually, if people simply just open their eyes, it is impossible not to be confronted with poverty from very early on, because regardless of whether we live in societies which are very affluent or not, poverty is always something that is surrounding us. It's a matter of opening one's eyes and seeing it and trying to understanding it and to doing something about it. Now, I always wondered, and I always was hoped that that people working in institutions and working professionally on poverty, I always thought, yes, I know, we started a little bit of late, and what we will do is the following. I am going to yield my time in the third session to myself in the first session. Okay, is that okay? So I am yielding my time. What's that? Borrowed time. Yes. Thank you. Time smoothing. Borrowed time. My God. Okay. So it's always important to start with this question, whether one is working on this in a professionally as an academic or whatever. It is always important to start with these questions and to do personal reflections of one's life. And why is that? Because the way that people understand and interpret and process poverty is something very, very experiential. It is very experiential. And again, we go back to the methodological point that we have been making the whole time, that knowledge is experiential. Now, this does not mean, though, I want to just caution us, when I say knowledge is experiential, it doesn't mean that you cannot understand experiences of people who are, you know, different from you. I can only understand my experience, so what I know is only based on my, it doesn't work like that, right? Knowledge is experiential. When we say that, what we're talking about is the experience of understanding things from a particular standpoint, a socially constructed standpoint, from your class position, from your gender identity, and so on. So that's what we mean. It doesn't mean that we can't understand people whose experiences are different from ours. Now, in this case, what is really needed, though, for us to be, first we have to, in the process of knowledge construction, we have to be aware of the fact that A, knowledge is experiential, and two, so that's on the table, so whatever claims we make to truth, the truth claims that we make are coming from a particular social positioning, particular social standpoint, but also that we need to make a conscious effort to understand the experiences and the knowledge of those whose social standpoint is different from ours. And what is necessary to be able to do that? What is necessary to do that? It is empathy. A certain emotional disposition is necessary to actually knowledge production. Knowledge is not simply about using our rationality and using, you know, 1 + 1 = 2, or maybe sometimes it doesn't equal 2. It's not about those kinds of capabilities to process. You know, it's not just about logic and so on. A certain emotional disposition is necessary to knowledge production. And nothing brings that out clearer than when we are talking about and discussing and trying to understand and trying to get rid of poverty. Nothing makes it clearer than the discussions of poverty. Why? And we saw examples of that. We saw examples in the stories that were told, right? A lot of the stories that were told were not things that happened to, for example, this accident did not happen to Taito, but she was a child. And what was she feeling? She was feeling empathy, but also she was asking the question, why, right? Why did this person lose a leg? same way Sylvia was asking the same question, why you were questioning the same thing. You were questioning, why should people die? In fact, maybe even take their own lives sometimes because they can't stand the pain. So empathy is the emotional state that we need to have if we really want to do something that is meaningful in terms of fighting poverty. We have to start with this. We have to make sure that we have that kind of emotional stance. Okay? But that is necessary for knowledge production of any type, not only about poverty. But it is very clear when we talk about poverty. Because in some ways, we are the privileged of the world. We wouldn't be here if we weren't. We have many privileges, and that's why we are here. We are the privileged people, and therefore we have what? We have an obligation, a responsibility, a moral imperative. A moral imperative to fight poverty. So, and I think we all, you know, agree on that. So I will not talk more about it because we all understand that and we feel that way. And the next point that I want to make is poverty is not a given condition. It is socially constructed and reproduced from one generation to another. And the reason that I am saying this is, especially for the younger folks here, you know, everybody in development has heard of the Millennium Development Goals, this alphabet soup that Alicia was calling an alphabet de letras, or how does it say it in Spanish? En español, por favor.
Alfabeto.
Alfabetización. Sopa de letras. This MDGs, PRSPs, da da da. And then after some time, these become, you know, so that point about why we do what we do is always something we have to remind ourselves, even when we're, and especially when we're working as a bureaucrat, whether this is in a government, in the academia, as a teacher, whatever, or in the United Nations and so on. We always have to remember, we always have to ask that story, when was the first time that I wanted to do something about it and why? Okay, we have to continually, otherwise we will get lost in these alphabets and soups and so on and so forth. Because poverty is not a given condition, it is socially constructed and reproduced from one generation to the other. Now, before the Millennium Development Goals and NDGs and so on and so forth, which are an expression of the international development community's recognition that poverty is something very wrong with poverty, there was a time when, you know, after the MDGs, it kind of became impolite to say, well, why should we care about poverty? You know, you all had to say, of course we care about poverty. The motto of the bank change, I know, on their website there, you know. So everybody is in the business of fighting poverty. That is on the surface of it, and the appearance is that everybody's in the service of fighting poverty. In fact, you know, the director of the IMF said, well, the IMF is a friend of the poor. Everybody became a friend of the poor all of a sudden. Because that's what happens when there are sort of international declarations and so on. Everybody who is a bureaucrat adjusts to that new imperative, the new declaration, and everybody start to become a friend of the poor, friend of the environment, and so on and so forth. Okay. Now, I am not saying that you know everyone who works in these institutions works this way. So please don't get me wrong. And I myself worked in them, so I know there are many, many people who are extremely committed. So I am not saying that at all. But there is a way in which this culture also works in this way. But before the days of the MDGs, really. You know, 20 years ago, when you were talking about the poor people and the macroeconomics of poverty, people would not tell you, oh, yes, we are all a friend of the poor. People would tell you, well, you know, that's just the way it is. I mean, macroeconomics, you have to do your macroeconomics this way because this is a technical matter. And then if there are poor people somewhere here, there, everywhere, then what we do is we go and do some help. We give them some help. You know, we do social funds, we do some, you know, this or that or and the other on the side. But, you know, macroeconomics is a technical matter. Right? There is sound macroeconomics and sound macroeconomic policies. And then if there are still some people sort of poor out here, we just go and do separate things for them. Okay, this, of course, is something that we have been fighting, because I'll tell you another personal story. I was in a conference in the late 80s at UCLA, which is the University of California in Los Angeles, and this was about structural adjustment and social consequences of structural adjustment. So anyway, I was given a paper there, and as usual, I went batty on the relationship between structural adjustment and poverty and gender and so on. And a very prominent economist from another country in the Middle East, and she was the dean of the social sciences, a very prominent university. She was an economist, and she said to me after the presentation, she said, we were going to lunch, she said, why do you care so much about the poor? I mean, why do you worry so much about the poor? Because I had really gone, you know, batty. And she said, why do you do that? You know, there will always be poor people. There were always poor people in this world, and there will always be poor people. And she said, for example, I have a woman who comes to clean my house, but these people are really, really lazy. They don't have ambitions. They don't want to do anything else. So they are poor people, and you know, this is the way it is. There will always. So I turned around, and what did I say? What would you say if you were me? What would you say? What would you say? What would you say? What would you say if you were me?
Do you live her life?
Sorry?
Maybe, what should I say is, do you live her life? Do you know how she grew? Do you know how the environment that she have to face? That's probably made a difference.
Do you know her life? Okay, you are trying to invoke empathy. You are trying to look for empathy. That's what you're doing with this woman. Well, clearly, she doesn't have any, because this is a person who comes to clean her house day in and day out. She herself is the employee of this woman, right? And for her to be able to say that, she probably doesn't have empathy, and she probably has closed her eyes. She's probably never been to the home of the woman who cleans her house. You know, she only sees it as the person cleaning her house. Mm-hmm. And she has this story, they are lazy, they are there, na 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 na. But you're doing something very interesting. Well, you're trying to invoke her empathy. I don't know what anybody else said. What I said was, yes, as long as there are people like you, there will be poverty. But it's only because there are people like you in the world who are in positions of power, and you have the authority to make knowledge claims and truth claims, because you are the dean, you're a very powerful woman. And as long as you're an economist, as long as somebody like you says that there will always, that will be a self-fulfilling prophecy. So the problem is not the poor people and how they don't want to work. The problem is people like you. And this is who I'm fighting. So, needless to say, I did not sit next to her at lunch. I don't think she wanted to sit next to me either. But I was outraged, and we need outrage. We really need to be outraged. We can't be polite. We can't afford to be polite, because the problem is there are people who are dying because of poverty. Poverty is something that kills. So we really can't be polite. It's not about politeness. So it's about really contesting and challenging, because poverty is a power relationship. It is not that, as this woman claimed, that there have been poor people from time immemorial. What can you do about it? You give a little bit of charity here, a little bit of something there. These people will always be poor. It is also the view of people in developing countries, by the way, sometimes, as it is portrayed from the north. Well, these countries are poor. They don't know anything, whatever. Those people are not very hard. They don't want to work hard. They have been poor from time immemorial. So, you know, this is really hard. You know, what can you do about it, kind of thing? Okay, so this is no different from either at the basis of individuals or at the basis of the country. Now, when I say poverty is socially constructed and reproduced, and when I say it's a power relation, and it's an intersection of power relations, actually, we have to also be cognizant of the fact. The reason that there are poor people in the world is because there are privileged people. So you can't talk about poor people in isolation from the privileged people. Okay? They are the two sides of the same coin. It's just like if there are countries that we call quote-unquote developing countries, third world, whatever world, and so on and so forth, it's because there is something called... That's what it is. If there are people who were colonized, that's because they were... colonizers. It is always the, what Marx called the master-slave dialectic, not in the sense of, I'm not talking about now about actual slavery and so on. But the point is here is just as the person who is oppressed needs somebody to be oppressing him or her, the oppressor needs someone that he or she can oppress in order to claim that position, right? So these are always this different sides of the same coin, and that's what's called the master-slave dialectic. Am I seeing a hand?
May I add something to this point, you see? In our countries, I mean transition countries, it is not the same, this slave and dialectic. You see, for instance, we often have babysitters and people who are cleaning our house with higher educational diplomas in their pockets, you see. The only reason that they are at this job, not because that they want to be and they have no education, but because there is no other job in our country. There's no other job in our country. And that's because our countries are poor. And most of our countries experience the same problems. Even I have a woman who is cleaning my house and he holds higher educational diploma, but I don't understand her problems, and we are, how to say, semi-friends to each other. And we are, maintaining respect relations to each other. I respect her work and respect her because he can manage to put away her diploma and go to job that is not correlate with her education in order to survive her children. I do respect this woman. I can say in our situation it's heroic. She can of course sit at home and crying and yelling that he has no money to feed up her children and nothing, and that's all. And she would be in rather more poverty than she is now.
And one of the things that I want to say when we talk about gender and poverty, this is one of the differences between men and women, is experiences of poverty. Women will be MDs, and then they will go and wipe floors if it is necessary for them to do so. And probably men who are MDs, if they lose their job, they might commit suicide rather than go and wipe somebody's floor. Russia, after shock therapy, which was, of course, all shock and no therapy, those were the responses, and a very typical response. In fact, in Turkey, for example, there are a lot of women who have migrated to Turkey from Moldova, who are nurses, who are MDs, who are working as caretakers in homes in Turkey. Many, many of them. Yes, absolutely. Yes, absolutely, absolutely, yeah, absolutely. So the notion that it is a power relation, and we have to understand that if there are poor people in the world, it is intimately related to the fact that there are also some people who are absolutely privileged. And it is the really product of poverty, is the product of intersecting inequalities of class, gender, race, and what I've been calling imperial relations, the North and the South, and the power of nations are not equal. And these power relations, in many ways, correspond to ownership and control of all kinds of property and assets. But I want us to think about assets in a broader sense than is usually done in economics. So these will be financial assets, land, capital, but also include knowledge and knowledge claims. And I will give you an example here. It is different. There's a difference between having knowledge and having the power to make knowledge claims, right? Indigenous people often know how to cure a number of, you know, diseases and so on and so forth. In our world, and they do not treat this as intellectual property or personal property, right? This is collective property. Collective is wisdom of humanity, really, right? They do not treat it as property, and this knowledge is used to heal people. What happens in a capitalist society? So that is knowledge. They have knowledge, and they use it to heal people, right? In all kinds of communities, you find that. I mean, my communities, my mother, you know, would have a way of healing a bruise on the head. You know, if you fell on the head, she would chew bread and stick it on your head. It was the starch in the bread that actually... You know, I mean, everybody's mother and grandmother has these kinds of remedies and so on. In modern times, what happened under capitalism? What happens to this knowledge? This knowledge becomes appropriated, really stolen from the people. By whom? By pharmaceutical companies who go to these all kinds of places in the world, who observe and so on and so forth, figure out, learn this knowledge, and then they actually turn it into intellectual property. And under capitalism, knowledge claims, intellectual property is a way of making knowledge claims and also excluding others from making the similar knowledge claims. So this is, you know, stealing of knowledge and using it in ways that are very harmful for humanity now, right? Because it's only the people who have the money now will be able to afford this medicine. And a number of the stories that you were telling me were actually about that. So what has happened here? Knowledge, which is power, has been appropriated, but not just appropriated, I really call it stealing, has been stolen. And knowledge claims are now no longer, can the people who originally were the depositories of this knowledge can no longer make these knowledge claims in the ways that they used to be able to make before, okay? So it is not just about, when I say that these inequalities, these power relations, it is not just about ownership of something, but also it is about the ability to exercise control over them. I'm going to give you another example of that is a gender example, which is that, as I was claiming the other day, I was making the assertion, and I will do this until somebody kills me, I will make this assertion. Women do not own. The majority of the assets in the world are owned by my men, and even when women own things in a formal legal sense, do they always have the control over the assets? No, very often they do not. So it is not only about ownership, formal ownership, but it is also about the ability to exercise power. In fact, one thing that everybody seems to own is something called labor power. Labor power is the commodified form of labor. Does everyone have equal ability and control over their labor power? No. What's a particular dividing line in terms of the ability to control one's own labor power? Gender, right? You may still, there are millions and gazillions of households in which women are not allowed to sell their labor power in the first place. So end of story. End of story. They have labor power, they have the capacity to do labor and to sell this in a labor market, presumably. But they are not even allowed to do that because they are nothing other than women, right? So God's children are not created equal, you know? We are the children of a lesser God, as I say. So this is the whole point. And here you see that there is a bit of a confluence of class relations with gender relations. Because in classical Marxism, classes are defined how? In terms of their relationship to the means of production, right? Means of production, right? So the capitalists who own the capital, proletariat, they don't own capital, they have nothing but their labor power to sell, right? They are freed, as in Marx's ironic terminology and double sense terminology, they are freed from the ownership of the means of production, right? They are freed, as Marx says, Marx calls it. And how about women, though? Under capitalism, under mapitalism, under feudalism, whatever you name. How about women? They are the ones who are really, really freed from the ownership of the means of production. And in fact, they are sometimes also, what? Severed from exercising the control over their own labor power, which is an inalienable right. It is an inalienable right. But women, millions, millions, millions of women in the world do not have that right. So, you know, when we're talking about the right to work, we are talking about something so deep, especially when it comes to women. You know, we've been having discussions about the right to work and so on and so forth. But the right to work is not just vis-a-vis the state. The right to work is what? First of all, really, for women, it starts in the home. The right to work, so please think about that, the right to work, the right to work. And I always... So on the one hand, we have women who are not allowed to work outside the house. On the other hand, and at the same time, these women's labor is actually extracted from them within the household as what kind of labor? Unpaid free labor. So think about those conditions and think about the relationship then between class and gender. Okay, so on the one hand, we have extraction of women's labor from women within the context of this institution that we call the household, and this is often through violence or threat of violence, because many women, women can actually be killed and shot for not cooking proper food, not going to the, that is the extreme manifestations of it, but they can be killed and shot. But then, you know, every day there are millions and billions of women who don't get shot. We don't see that violence immediately in front of our eyes. But either they have been subjected to some lesser type of violence, not being shot necessarily, or they are always living under conditions of threat of violence. Okay, so there is a lot between, you know, economics is so much about violence that we could go on and on forever. But, so on the one hand, you have women who are not allowed to work outside the home, but the same women's labor is being extracted in the home, free of charge, and under really conditions of what I call structural violence. violence. And that's why, you know, when we always talk about also these conventions of the ILO, the fundamental rights at work, and so on and so forth, I always say freedom from violence and conditions of work, this is sort of the life of maybe the majority of women in the world. And these are all very economic realities that we have to think about. So when I say, I'm going to talk about this when we talk about gender and poverty further, but when I am saying that these are power relations, there are power relations that correspond to ownership and control of all kinds of property and assets and so forth, I am talking about some very broad understandings of power, of asset, property, and resources, and I now lost my. I put it somewhere. Oh, it's on my jacket. I'm talking about something very broad, and it is not just that in some period in history, you know, some people ended up with property and other people didn't. Some by some accident, there is a continuous process of appropriation. There is a continuous process of appropriation that takes place every day on an everyday basis. So this is what we must be cognizant of. So I said if there are poor people, that is because there are privileged people who not only have assets, but also because they appropriate in many ways whatever little the poor people have. Knowledge extraction, labor extraction from women by men in the household through the use of violence or threat of violence or even exchange. You know, civilized market exchanges are also part of the process. I am not going to go into them. Now, the condition of poverty is violence, as I've been saying. It is structural violence, and poverty produces violence over distribution. So one of the things I always want to caution people is that poverty itself is a condition of structural violence. It reproduces violence. And of course, we shouldn't romanticize poor people. Poor people do lots of horrible things, just like not so poor people, okay? They don't come from a different species of, so we shouldn't romanticize poor people, but they also do lots of wonderful things, just like everybody else, okay? But the conditions under which they live in is very conducive to also violence. Because when you have so little, sometimes there will be distributive conflicts in a society because there is so little to go around. But very often what you actually see in the lives of everyday lives of poor people is that if you go to a village, actually poor people are extremely generous, because the kind of economic mindset that they have is the moral economy, right? If they don't share, because everybody is living at such a low standard of living, if there isn't serious sharing and redistribution, people may not survive. So the ethics of a village is to share, right? So that is the moral economy. That's what we call the moral economy. But sometimes also you get extremely violent social conflicts over distribution. These often take the form of communal violence of between different races and ethnic groups and so on and so forth. But really behind them is economics of distribution. And in some sense, I will say everyone is in one sense living with poverty. Nobody is really innocent. And therefore, we are all responsible for both its reproduction and elimination. And what do we mean by that? We are all living with poverty. What do I mean by that? I made a similar point the other day about gender and gender discrimination alone. I made that point the other day. I want to repeat this point again. There is no such thing as a civilized economy. You could be look like a very civilized economy. For example, the wage gaps in your gender-based wage gaps in your economy may be very small because you have done comparable work or whatever. You have done all kinds of things. You have good trade unions, nice, etc., etc. But you are still not going to be freed of gender discrimination. You are still not going to be an innocent economy. Why? I made this point the other day in the context of international trade, and I said, if you are connected to the rest of the world economy through trade, investment, whatever, migration, you are still, and the prices, all the prices in the world economy are, all the price structures are prices of discrimination. And this is systemic and systematic, right? That's what I said. So you could be a very nice, civilized looking economy, but you are not innocent. And again, you could be a very nice, civilized-looking economy. You are not innocent in the sense that everybody becomes a part of that system that produces and reproduces poverty. Because if there is a woman who had a very an MD or a very high degree education who has to go and migrate to the other end of the world to work as in whatever capacity, what has happened to that? What's happening? Well, the people in the civilized economy are enjoying the benefits of our labor. And why is what is she doing up there? Because her country has experienced a sudden and incredible kind of shock and impoverishment, right? So then the people who are receiving these people as workers are enjoying the fruits of poverty in another country. So nobody is innocent in that sense. That's what I mean. Nobody is innocent, and the same thing is true of gender discrimination, but also of class and, of course, of poverty. Now, historically, many spiritual and religious systems were cognizant of this, of poverty. You know, moral and ethical belief systems always take poverty into account, so I'm not going to go through that because you already know that in terms of tithing and, you know, Christ and the money changers and all of that. So I'm not going to go on that. But through the onset, with the onset of capitalism, dispossession became systematic and sort of took a different form. Remember that idea of appropriation and that idea of dispossession that we talked about, that became systematic and took on a different nature with the onset of capitalism, and that's the period of what we call primitive accumulation in historical terms, when people got severed from the land, with the enclosures and so on, they got thrown off the land, and that's how they became wage laborers, while another class of people turned into the class of capitalists. So that's the period of primitive accumulation, and this is what we see in the former Soviet countries today. That was a very, very, very drastic process. There also came a point in history where it became possible to separate the moral imperatives from the economic, from the way economic relations are understood. Through neoclassical economics, and this is a correspondence to the rise of capitalism, we cannot go into these very interesting questions, but in economics, though, so in the old days, it was your spiritual traditions, religious traditions that said something to you about poverty, how everybody had to do something about almsgiving, et cetera, et cetera. So religions were systems of also redistribution, right? There were redistribution, and they had an economic role to play, religious belief systems, and they still do in many ways. But as we have the construction of capitalism in history, we also have a corresponding social thought that we can call neoclassical economics, in which there came to be this distinction between positive and normative. So positive was the is when you are actually doing a scientific analysis of something, and the normative economics is when you are doing what? When you are dealing with values, but these are always two of them are separate, and normative is sort of you deal with the social welfare function. This is actually sort of where you are doing the charity work, right? This is the charity of the economics, right? Economics, that's where your social welfare function, and you say, how on earth do you come up with a social welfare function? Of course, there is the impossibility theorem and so on, but there is the positive and the normative, the distinction between these two. Now, in some sense, in the historical case. So you could keep these two things separate, right? You did not consider, and you do not consider the fact that when you're doing whatever you call positive analysis, positive economics, is the very thing that is reproducing things like poverty, right? Inequality, for which then you have to undertake another set of actions in order to deal with. So this kind of schizophrenia, which of course we have been criticizing all along. But in the real world of capitalism, if you will, through the construction of the welfare state, and I put it as a state, I'm sorry, that should be welfare state in the north, it became sort of the responsibility to mediate this structural violence that we call poverty. Because if you have too much of it, then what happens? Chaos and the system collapses, capitalism will collapse. So you have to kind of contain. And therefore, what you need to do is the state emerges as the institution which mediates this structural violence and the that we call poverty and the causes and the consequences of structural causes. So either capitalism is going to be negated totally through violence, right? There's going to be total chaos or violence or revolution or whatever, or we have enlightened capitalism where the state becomes the distributor to ameliorate this structural violence, this type of structural violence. So in this sense, I have been talking and I have been saying in many discussions that the state has to be, the capitalist state has to be problematized, right? It cannot be taken as being either incompetent or corrupt and whatever, or as being good, made up of technocrats who know what they're doing. The state has to be problematized, and the state is always the site of distributive struggles. Now, what came to in the historical revolution, and of course I'm jumping over many, many things, but citizenship, citizenship, the notion of citizenship and capitalist state entailed the idea of citizenship as people being entitled to certain things. So that when we are talking about the kinds of things that people receive in the context of the welfare state or other kinds of non-advanced capitalist states, we can see the things that people receive as entitlements and not sort of privileges or charities that are being done to people. Right? There is a sense in which we should put the language of entitlements forward. Because there is a structural component of capitalism actually that disables people to live decent lives, decent and dignified lives. Right? When we were talking at the beginning, we said getting rid of poverty is also about making sure that people live decent and dignified lives, that they are respected as human beings. So in that sense, we have to understand the rights that we talk about as economic rights, as rights that we claim within the context of the state, as entitlements. And we have to be talking about the notion of group rights, not understand rights as individual rights, but as group rights. And we have to do macroeconomics of entitlements and rights. Now, what is the difference between what we are saying here and the human development approach? Because the human development paradigm, and I think Sanjay is going to talk about that, the human development and human poverty concepts, all of those different kinds of concepts of poverty, is also recognizing poverty and redefining poverty in a way that is much broader than it has been defined until then. But what I want to finish by saying is that as we talk about poverty, we should not simply interpret it as a microeconomic phenomena or as the attribute of an individual, and therefore we should not think about eliminating poverty from the point of view of helping each and every individual by giving them some entitlements or by giving them some rights. As I said, entitlements are rights. Those are ways of claiming our economic rights. We all have economic rights, social rights, and political rights by virtue of being human beings, because of our humanity. But we cannot think of these rights sort of from a very individual and individualistic point of view, because rights, at the end of the day, rights have to, and rights and entitlements all have to add up, right? I mean, I make my claim, you make yours, and so on and so forth. And somehow, these claims that we all might be making, they all have to add up to a whole, and they have to be enforced, but they all have to add up. And of course, as always, the sum of the parts is, the whole is always greater than the sum of the parts. And sometimes it might, as I say, and I keep joking, that sometimes it's less, but it's never equal to the sum. The whole is even sometimes more, sometimes never equal. But the point is that all of these claims that we all make as groups have to somehow add up to the whole. And that, in a way, is what the state is about. It is the site in which groups of people make their claims, and there is a struggle over those claims in the context of the state. And that is why we have to talk about macroeconomics of poverty. Macroeconomics of poverty. We cannot just approach it as a microeconomic problem, micro-level problem, or micro-individual level understanding. We have to have an understanding, of course, from the level of the experience of the people, individual people, and so on and so forth, but we have to always situate this in the context of the whole, from a philosophical point of view, the whole, but from a more from a more economics point of view, in the macroeconomics, right? The difference between what we are saying and what we have been saying, for example, in this course, and what lots of other people say, and sort of the certain versions of the human development paradigm or the approach of Amartya Sen and others, is that the human development approach, of course, we all learn a lot from this. But it doesn't have a macroeconomic, chapeau, hat. It really doesn't. And so where we are coming from is we talk about, you know, feminist economics, or you can call it humanist economics, whatever you want to talk about it. But we are talking about not only the sum of the parts, but we are always talking about the whole thing, right? Or the macroeconomics, or in this case, macroeconomics of poverty reduction. So this is where we must be also starting from, not from the necessarily from the individual, but we must be also talking about the whole and see that this is all about distribution and claims over distribution, claims over made by different people. Now, the next thing that I was going to talk about was that poverty is generally portrayed as income poverty, as a shortfall on income, which corresponds to a certain level of consumption. But that is only a manifestation of the processes that reproduce poverty. And there are many different implications of this, but now I'm going to turn this over to Sanjay in the next session, and he will tell us all about how not to count the poor. And in some sense, I was talking about how not to think about the poor. And I think Sanjay is going to talk about, among other things, how not to count the poor, as well as other things. Thank you very much. I've run over my time.